This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last month, a Shrewsbury man named Frank Weir was arrested for the murder of his longtime girlfriend, Donna Marzilli. When he called 911, Weir told the dispatcher that they'd been in a fight and she had been shot. He's pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree murder and domestic assault, but press accounts quote neighbors saying there was a history of domestic violence in the relationship. When domestic violence leads to murder, guns are involved more than half the time. And victim advocates say that a domestic violence victim in a household with guns is far, far more likely to be killed than one living in a house without guns. That's one of the issues that law enforcement officers and people working on domestic violence prevention and intervention struggle with. Today on the program, we're going to talk about the persistent issue of domestic violence and some of the programs in Vermont designed to address it. I'm joined now by Karen Tronsgaard-Scott, Executive Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. It's nice to talk with you again.
Nice to see you, Jane.
And also by Captain Ingrid Jonas, Staff Operations Commander for the Vermont State Police. She oversees recruiting and training, which includes training in how police respond to domestic violence cases. Hello again to you as well, Captain Jonas.
Good afternoon.
So, Karen, maybe we could start with you to just help outline the scope of the problem of domestic violence in Vermont. And you could tell us what you see from your perspective running the Vermont network, and then we'll broaden that out.
Domestic violence continues to be one of the most pervasive and most dangerous crimes committed in Vermont. And, you know, the ultimate crime, of course, is homicide. We have a commission in Vermont called the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission, and they look every year at fatalities related to domestic violence. And what we know from the commission is over the course of the past 10 years, more than 52% of all homicides in Vermont are related to domestic violence, and of those, 57% involve the use of a firearm. So domestic violence continues just to be one of the significant factors in the lives of Vermonters.
And that's just when it's escalated all the way to murder. I mean, you must also see domestic violence as an issue that doesn't rise to the level of something that's reported to the police.
Absolutely. You know, we represent the 14 organizations that provide direct services to victims of domestic and sexual violence. And those programs served over 8,000 people last year. That's a number that's continued to rise over the years, over nearly 20,000 hotline calls. So we are seeing that people are reaching out to these programs, but many domestic violence victims are, you know, living in the shadows and living in isolation. We know that there's so many more people that need help.
Ingrid Jonas, for you, what do you see as a police officer and somebody who has worked in this field before and now somebody as a captain who trains the Vermont State Police and police trainees about this issue? How much of an issue is it in Vermont from your perspective?
Well, we recognize that domestic violence cases are some of the most serious and dangerous cases we handle as police. And we know that by the time that we respond, the incidents have been going on for probably quite some time, and we know that we're handling several cases, but it's just the tip of the iceberg as far as the prevalence of the problem in Vermont.
Karen, how bad typically does it have to get before somebody reaches out for help, before a victim reaches out either to an organization like the ones that you work with or to the police?
You know, it's changed over the years. Back when I started doing this work 22 years ago, people were generally, things had gone pretty far before they reached out to an organization like Women Helping Battered Women here in Chittenden County. Today, people are reaching out a little bit earlier, but it is, even the basics of what's going on in these families, even the psychological abuse is quite serious and really damaging. And I certainly have talked to hundreds and hundreds of victims over the years who said the physical violence was hard, the psychological abuse was soul-crushing.
Can you tell me a little bit, maybe an anecdote, about what you're talking about with psychological violence so that people can start to understand what you're looking at and what you see with victims of domestic violence?
Well, there's a pattern of coercion that happens in violent relationships, and that pattern is established on a kind of a relentless undermining of self-esteem by the dominant partner, by the abusive partner. And so it starts with small things like comments about looks or comments about ability, but then it grows and grows until the person who's entered that relationship as a fully actualized adult suddenly feels like the ground underneath them is just continuously shifting, and they learn to not trust their own instincts. And that's, we see this typically really over and over again in these relationships.
I think of the three of us, none of us have used any gender pronouns here. And that's probably, at least on my part, intentional. But, you know, I think many people think women are most often the victims in domestic and sexual violence. And that's mm-hmm. true. But it's not just an issue for women being victims.
Oh, certainly not. Domestic violence occurs also in same-sex relationships. And there are times when men are also victims of domestic violence. The thing that I've learned over the years is that the root cause of domestic violence is sexism. And even in a relationship where the victim is a male, there's still an element of sexism. And just anecdotally, I remember serving a man years and years ago, and the words, the patterns and the words that his abusive female partner used were the same as I'd heard over and over again being used by male abusers toward a female victim. And of course, you know, in this state where we have the highest per capita number of LGBT community members, we have to really pay attention to the fact that this is a phenomenon that happens in same-sex relationships as well.
We are shining a spotlight today on the issue of domestic violence. In 2015, the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence served almost 7,000 victims and got more than 16,000 calls to its hotline. Listeners, if you have a story to tell, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or if you'd like to ask a question about how domestic violence and police work intersect, or what kind of training police officers in Vermont get in regards to domestic violence, post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or again, call 1-800-639-2211. Captain Jonas, can you tell us a little bit about what the training for police officers actually entails when it comes to domestic violence training?
I can. Well, in 2008, law was passed that required law enforcement across the state to receive at least 8 hours of domestic violence training. In a program that was approved by the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council, which is the body that oversees training requirements for police, and also in partnership with Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, we, our recruits through the Vermont Police Academy, are getting 12 hours of classroom training regarding domestic violence, 24 hours of training, which includes an additional 24 hours of sexual violence, child abuse, and information about human trafficking. There's additional hours that cover stalking and voyeurism, strangulation, and vulnerable adult abuse. It's important, and you were talking about the pattern, or Karen was talking about the patterns of behaviors, and really regarding this training, we can't approach domestic violence the same way that we would other types of violent crime. So there's a big difference between the context and meaning and effect on a person than just random violence or, say, for example, a barroom brawl. We're going to handle it very differently. You know, battering is a pattern of behaviors, both legal and illegal, which work to gain and maintain control over the victim, and so we need to investigate it by asking the right questions. This is often referred to as sort of looking at domestic violence in a course of conduct, meaning a pattern of conduct composed of a series of acts over a period of time, not just what happened tonight. We need to ask the right questions so we really develop the case to its full extent.
Is there training on issues like gender sensitivity, or not assuming that in a same-sex relationship it's always going to be the female who's the victim and the male who's the perpetrator? Because I imagine you do get into patterns and knowing what is typically happening, and then for an officer getting involved in a situation, you must have to evaluate each one individually.
That's correct. You know, these are complicated cases, and batterers are good at trying to shift the blame. That's one of their tactics. So we really do need to rise to the challenge and understand that our role is to ask the right questions to figure out who is the dominant aggressor, who has been wielding power and control over over their partner.
Captain Jonas, you also mentioned that this is one of the more dangerous situations for law enforcement officers. Can you detail a little bit why going into a domestic violence call can be so dangerous for responders?
Well, you know, our work is unpredictable when officers respond to any type of call. You know, we have to be thinking tactically, and we also have to be thinking about how we're going to conduct this investigation. And, you know, when you're going into someone's home and you don't know what is in that home as far as weapons, of course, we're going to assume there are weapons or things that could be used as weapons. But when you enter a home, it has a different, it presents different tactical issues than other types of cases that you respond to.
You've also mentioned in the past that because these are so complicated, these situations, that sometimes a responding officer will find that the victim in the situation can also turn on the officer because of fear or because it's a complicated relationship when you are being abused, but you also love your abuser.
Absolutely. Out of legitimate fear, you know, survivors of domestic violence will lack trust in our ability to really protect them. And in fact, they think their safer bet may be to side with the offender. I believe that down the line, the majority of victims whose partners have been arrested will actually ask to have those charges dismissed. So we're dealing with really difficult practical and psychological issues that victims are facing.
Karen Tronsgaard-Scott, that must be something that you deal with as well in coaching victims, in counseling and working with victims and helping them get out of abusive relationships, that very complicated idea of a really intertwined relationship.
These are really complex relationships. All, my experience is that all relationships are pretty complicated. but in these situations where there's coercion, the thing to understand is that the most dangerous time of in a violent relationship is at the point at which the abused partner leaves. And we've seen this over and over and over again where the couple's been separated for quite some time and then the abusive partner commits a homicide. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that we've asked our law enforcement community to do a pretty hard job, which is to go into a situation where there's been a crime committed, and the primary witness to the crime and the victim of the crime may or may not agree with the way that law enforcement is charged with responding to the crime by our laws. This gets magnified exponentially when that couple is a part of a marginalized group. So think about the relationship between communities of color and law enforcement. Think about the relationship between the system for immigrants or for people who are here without paperwork, who are undocumented. So you know, we're so fortunate in Vermont because our law enforcement community and the Vermont Network and advocates, we all share a common goal, which is safety. It doesn't necessarily mean somebody's going to leave the relationship to maximize safety. But the training that our law enforcement community has gotten, especially the training of leadership in our law enforcement community, is really making a difference.
So you think Vermont law enforcement does a good job in this area?
I do. I do. You know, we've worked with Ingrid Captain Jonas for years and years. She's a superstar as far as we're concerned. And to know that she's now in charge of training is terrific. And, you know, we're so happy to have a female in that role. The last year in 2014 or 2015, the International Association of Chiefs of Police came to Vermont and did their training on law enforcement leadership and violence against women crimes. 22 law enforcement leaders participated in that training, and they spent a week. Imagine chiefs and sheriffs and Vermont State Police together in a hotel conference room for a week without access to their email and telephones, which I think shows incredible dedication and incredible concern about these crimes. They walked away from that experience with new determination to do a great job in investigating these crimes and supporting safety in our communities.
Let's go to William, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, William. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Jane. This is something I've heard, and I'm very confused about it and would like it straightened out, and that is the threat expert, Gavin DeBecker, has warned against going to the police for things like stalking and psychological abuse because there's really no evidence that such has occurred, and thus all the police can do is chat and really nothing else, and thus the abuser comes out on top. And just see what your guests can run with that.
William, thanks for the call. Captain Jonas, I'd love your take on that.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I'm following the question. I know that sometimes we can go too far. You know, as law enforcement, we can go too far in trying to tell someone what they need to do. And, you know, we know that victims and their family may be downplaying a risk. We need to communicate our concern in a respectful way.
I think what William's more suggesting is, what if there's no physical violence or physical evidence of domestic abuse, but somebody is saying, I'm being emotionally abused, I'm being intimidated, you know, this seems to me a dangerous situation, but not one where there's going to be physical evidence. What role can the police play when there's a lack of physical evidence?
Right, well, we can facilitate plugging victims into support systems. So basically, there are abuse prevention orders that can cover, that serve to protect someone who's in fear of serious imminent bodily injury. But it's, you know, not all tactics of abuse involve actual violation of law. So a person can be in fear for their life, and a law may not have been violated. Karen, would you agree?
I do agree, Ingrid. I think that one of the most important things that our law enforcement officers do when they arrive at a scene, even if there hasn't been, if there's no evidence of a crime being committed, is, you know, they're arriving at that scene, they're breaking into that situation, and they have a unique role as law enforcement leaders to be able to make a referral. So that somebody knows exactly where they can go to get help when they're ready to.
Captain Jonas, you mentioned the training that all incoming officers in the state now get in regards to domestic and sexual violence and similar crimes. Are we actually seeing any kind of success in domestic violence prevention that you would tie to the training that officers get?
Prevention, you know, I wish that we were able to do more prevention. I feel like police really respond after the fact. I wish that I could say that police stop domestic violence. We interrupt it, certainly, and we're one part of this puzzle, but we cannot really end domestic violence per se. We have to work cohesively with the, you know, sort of other stakeholders to do that. We can certainly be leaders. We can certainly ensure that our department's leadership enhances our response and changes culture and attitudes about these crimes. But I'm sad to say that I don't think that we alone can end domestic violence. It is rooted in our culture, and we can be part of changing the culture. But
so where does the training help then?
Training helps in how we respond. So effective training helps us fully understand the issue, ask the right questions so that we're really getting a full sense of when this started. So in other words, if you respond to a domestic assault and you have, you know, you may have clear probable cause that you know, someone was physically hurt. Well, you don't just leave it at that. You will find out, when did this start? You will interview other witnesses in the home if they're willing to speak with you. You'll take a look at it from a bigger perspective than just what occurred, you know, a half hour before you arrived on the scene. And you will, when you present your case to the court, when you call for bail that night, you will have in front of you a better sense of the whole breadth of the case. So not just now, but did this person commit similar crime in another state? Can you get a hold of that paperwork? Can you get a sense of whether they violated conditions of release or violated abuse prevention orders in the past? So you're really not looking at it as what just happened on this one date, but where it started, the things that the person did that were patterns of behavior, some legal, some illegal. Some, we'll talk about the emotional abuse as well as the physical abuse. Emotional abuse technically isn't against the law, but we will include that in our case.
That's Captain Ingrid Jonas. She's Staff Operations Commander for the Vermont State Police. She oversees recruiting and training, and she's been talking a little bit about the training that all police officers in Vermont now get on domestic violence. Captain Jonas, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Karen Tronsgard-Scott, stay with us. We're talking about domestic violence in Vermont today. Coming up, we're going to talk about how a lack of affordable housing in Vermont means many victims have no place to go when they try to leave an abusive relationship. We'll also address the connection between domestic violence and firearms. And if you have a question or you'd like to share your own experience, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about the issue of domestic violence and how advocates are trying to work on both prevention and how best to address the needs of victims. We've been hearing from the police perspective, and we're talking now with Karen Tronsgard-Scott, Executive Director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Anne, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I'm wondering what the relationship is between the rates of unemployment as it goes up and the occurrences of domestic violence. Is there an increase, and is there a relationship there, or mathematical or statistical or whatever?
Yeah, and thanks for the call. Karen?
But there, you know, domestic violence is about coercion, and so there's not a causal relationship between unemployment or other social problems and domestic violence, in that it's not caused, domestic violence is not caused by anger or tension. Domestic violence is caused by this preponderance of a belief system that allows one person to believe that they have the right to engage in a coercive, power-based relationship with their intimate partner without regard to what they need to do to maintain that relationship. So if it's psychological abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, that's all justified in that abuser's head. That said, unemployment and economics have a huge impact on victims of domestic violence and children who are living in violent homes, because the domestic violence interrupts their ability to earn money and also interrupts their ability to gain access to state-sponsored supports, especially when they want to leave that violent relationship.
Well, let's talk about the housing issue, too, because this is, I mean, speaking of economic problems, if a victim does want to leave a relationship, you've said that one of the problems in Vermont is this lack of affordable housing that makes victims at least feel like there's nowhere for them to go. How does that problem sort of crash into this issue of domestic violence?
Well, it meets homelessness and the lack of affordable housing meets domestic violence in many ways. So one of the primary ways is that we see a bottleneck in shelters. For years and years, the average length of stay in a shelter was 22 days. Over the course of the past 5 years in Vermont, that's increased to 35 days. That's a pretty significant increase when you think about the whole breadth of all the people who are staying in shelter. And what we're hearing from survivors and from the advocates that serve them is that there's just no place for them to go. There's no housing. We know, you know, we live in a community in Chittenden County where there's, now we're, you know, it's just doubled, 1.6% vacancy rate.
This is in Burlington.
In Burlington, right. There's just no place for folks to go. And then so what happens is we've got many people who are in situations, many victims of domestic violence and their kids, and they're homeless. So this morning I was in an event with sponsored by the Commission on Women that was looking at homelessness. Domestic violence was certainly present in that conversation. We know that one in three families who are staying in emergency hotels, these are folks that have no place to go. They get a voucher from the state to stay at a hotel. One in three of those families are leaving domestic violence. One in three. Rita Markley, who's the director of COTS, spoke this morning. She said between 22 and 57% of the people that COTS are serving are homeless primarily because of domestic violence. It's a huge impact. And the relationship between, so domestic violence survivors have a choice to make. They can enter into homelessness, and you know, even those beds are really stretched. And once you're on the street, of course, the the likelihood that you'll be subject to a victim of other kinds of physical violence and sexual violence increases exponentially. And so you can either do that and try to find a place to live and you know that your children are going to be with you, or you can stay in an abusive relationship.
That's a pretty untenable situation.
That's right.
For victims.
That's right.
So, I mean, how in the world then do advocates and do the programs that you work with at the Vermont Network try to help victims get out of these situations, given what you just said about a lack of affordable housing, the rates of homelessness, and even the bottleneck in shelters?
Well, there's a couple things. So, you know, the people that are working with victims, these advocates that we represent, are incredibly, incredibly resourceful. And they've established relationships in their communities with the housing trusts, with other developers, with their churches, with people in the community that who share a goal for around community safety and want to see these families coming out of violent homes have the opportunity to thrive. There's we are also asking our government to help with this. There's a social safety net that's been frankly dismantled over the course of the last several years. And it's about, it comes down to money. And so right now we have a bill in the legislature that seeks to add a 2% charge on hotel stays. They're calling this the latte charge. I was just at a coffee shop. A latte costs $4. It's a shot of espresso charge. $2 is what a shot of espresso costs. $2 on a hotel stay in Vermont will raise $12 million.
And you said a 2% charge. It's a
$2 charge.
Charge,
yes,
right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, 2%. That it's just $2 cost of a cup of espresso. That charge will raise estimates of $12 million to help with the housing and homelessness problem.
And do you think that that's going to come through? Do you think the legislature is going to back it?
It would be great if the legislature would back it. We'll certainly be asking them to.
Karen, I want to also raise this issue of firearms. You know, compared to many other states, there's not a lot of gun violence in Vermont. Mm-hmm. But when there is, it is often associated with domestic violence. Can you draw that connection?
Well, we know that in violent homes, there's been many studies. In violent homes, the incidence of homicide increases significantly when there's a firearm in the home. A person is 12 times more likely to be murdered or killed with a firearm in a violent home. We know that in Vermont, as I said earlier, 57% of all the domestic violence-related homicides are committed with a firearm.
So what are you looking for when you try to address how domestic violence prevention efforts mix with gun restrictions? Because this is a big issue in Vermont.
Well, I think that we can look to studies coming out of Johns Hopkins University that show us that there are patterns that domestic violence abusers who end up killing their partners engage in. We know that they are more likely to kill their partner when there's a firearm present. We know that they're more likely to kill their partner when there's a history of domestic violence that's documented and chronicled through law enforcement involvement. We know that they're more likely to kill their partner when there's a history of animal abuse. And interestingly, when there's stepchildren in the home. So this is evidence-based lengthy studies on this. So what we're looking for is we're looking to be in partnership with our law enforcement community and our courts so that when there's a relief from abuse order issued from our courts.
Sometimes thought of as a restraining order.
That's right. Or when there's a conviction of domestic abuse or domestic assault, that those firearms are confiscated from those homes.
Isn't that what's supposed to happen by law anyway?
Yes.
But you're saying it's not happening.
What I'm saying is that it's happening not as much as we would like it to happen. So it's a new law. We passed it last year. One of the challenges is where those guns go. We're hoping that we can develop more firearm confiscation sites so there's a place for the guns to go. But it's absolutely critical that the guns get confiscated.
And we will have an upcoming story about gun storage here on Vermont Edition in the coming weeks. Karen, before we let you go, you know, you mentioned that the root of domestic violence is sexism. How do we get at this whole prevention side of things.
We have to really go far up the river. Right now we're at this place where people are drowning in the river. We need to go back to the root causes. And to be able to do that, that means all of us need to be talking about domestic violence and talking about what's happening in homes and learning about it, especially men. We really need men to step up to this conversation and to engage with their partners and with their family, with their friends, and to recognize that sexism really is the place where this starts. If you have a fundamental belief that men are better than women and you're willing to engage in and build systems that keep women in subordinate roles, then you're contributing to the root of domestic violence.
And does that start then with kids and teenagers? I mean, how do you address that?
Certainly. And the member programs of the domestic violence provide thousands of hours a year of training and intervention with kids and youth.
Any progress you're seeing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that the people that come into shelter are coming in so much later in the process tells me that all of those people that used to come into shelter much earlier in the process are finding ways to deal with it. And we also see that youth are much more in tune with sexism and other kinds of oppression in general.
Karen Tronsgaard-Scott is the executive director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We have the statewide hotlines on our website, vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition to find them. Karen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and now it's time for Dorothy's List, our series about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month during the school year, we visit with middle grade students reading one of the books nominated. This month, students from Burlington's two middle schools got together to discuss The Art of Secrets by James Kleiss. VPR's Amy Noyes was there.
When this group of students from Hunt and Edmonds Middle Schools got together to discuss The Art of Secrets, some of them were meeting for the first time. So Edmonds librarian Carol Rensa started them out with a matching game to allow the students to mingle. Some students had cards with the names of characters from The Art of Secrets, and others had cards with descriptions of the characters.
What about Saba's father?
There are a lot of characters in The Art of Secrets, and we hear from each of them throughout the novel. We hear the narrator's voices through emails, journal entries, text messages, investigative reports, and snippets of conversation. The unique format draws different reactions from these Burlington middle schoolers. Some students find it hard to follow the mystery, but others like that it keeps them guessing.
It's quite interesting, but also confusing. Like, guess and work out through what information you have.
Because at the ending, I was really confused. It confused me. I had to, like, reread it again and again until I found out.
It kind of makes you have to go deeper and infer some things. I like books that make you think.
That was Burlington students Emily Widjawadi, Khalid Barwani, and Theo Ellis-Novotny. They all had questions for the author of The Art of Secrets, and so did 8th grader Pearson Nitz Caldwell.
How did you come up with this idea for such a cool story and such a cool format for it?
We put Pearson's question and questions from the other Burlington middle schoolers to author James Kleiss.
My initial inspiration was that I wanted to write a mystery, and when you write a mystery, you always start with the point of view of the person who's committed the crime. And so I came up initially with the crime story. I knew what the crime was. I knew how the crime would unfold. I knew who was responsible for the crime. And what I didn't know is how this community of characters would respond to each development of the story.
Saba Khan is the main character in The Art of Secrets. She's a first-generation Pakistani-American. The story starts out when Saba's family's apartment is destroyed by fire. The police say it's arson, and it might be a hate crime. Edmonds 7th grader Najma Malawiya has this question for the author.
Why did you choose Saba's family to be from Pakistan?
I live on the north side of Chicago, which is a remarkably diverse place, racially, ethnically. And one of my goals as a writer is to make sure that my books reflect the diversity of the place where I live. And in this case, I began the book in the fall of 2008. And that was a time when Muslim Americans were experiencing a lot of discrimination on the north side of Chicago. And I was thinking a lot about how it must be to be part of a community but to be treated like an outsider. And so when I was assembling the characters for this story, I knew that I wanted to include a Pakistani-American family to put at the center of that.
Edmund's seventh grader Emma Lowry noticed the outsider experience is central to the story in The Art of Secrets, and she asks author James Kleiss about that.
Your book is all about outsiders, and were you ever an outsider in your life? How does that relate to your book?
Oh, absolutely, I've been an outsider in my life. I think everybody has. Insider and outsider status is one of the great themes of young people's literature because it's a universal experience that sometimes you're going to walk into a situation and feel like you're an absolute insider and that you are with the in crowd, you are part of the power dynamic, and you're in control. And there are plenty of other times in your life when you feel like you're on the outskirts and not included. And I certainly went through times in my life where I felt like I was not popular enough or powerful enough. Sometimes you're going to feel like an insider. Sometimes you're going to feel like an outsider. And for me, what's most interesting is what do you do with that position?
And Emma had this observation.
The book itself is sort of different from other mysteries, and it makes it an outsider a little bit.
Hunt's sixth grader Miles Ellis Novotny's favorite character in the book is a foreign exchange student named Javier.
What gave you the idea for making the character Javier?
Javier's one of my favorite characters in the book. He's from Spain. So in telling the story, I wanted there to be different degrees of insiderness and outsiderness, if that makes sense. Javier was a great character to bring in. He's such an obvious outsider. He's from a different culture. And I knew that because he was an outsider, he might end up a suspect in some of the crimes that take place on campus.
Many of the characters, like Javier, are students or teachers at Subba's high school. The school community rallies around Subba and her family. Kevin and Kendra Spoon are new kids at school. They organize a fundraising auction for the Khan family. Here's author James Kleiss reading an excerpt from The Art of Secrets. In this scene, Kevin Spoon is telling a newspaper reporter about the fundraiser.
I mean, there are other motives for helping Saba's family. As sad as it sounds, and my sister will never admit this, Saba's tragedy is Kendra's social opportunity. It's barely November, and people know who my sister is, and they like her, you know? All because of this auction project. Wait, please don't put that in the paper. That sounds cold. Best way to put it is, Kendra and I want to help this family. The whole school does. It's no big mystery. It's not crop circles. It just feels good to help people, right? It's the decent thing to do. That's where we're coming from.
With so many different narrators throughout the book, Emmons eighth grader Clara Martone wonders why we don't hear more from the protagonist.
Since Saba was the main character, why did you have her only write in journal entries? Like a couple times throughout the whole book, instead of having her just be the whole narrator, since the story was about her life.
I wanted to make sure that there was at least one narrator in the book that the reader could trust was telling the truth. Because Saba's writing in her journal, and, you know, a personal journal is not generally shared with other people, we knew that she would be honest in her account of her feelings and her motives and her observations as the story progresses.
Edmund's seventh grader, Adeep Gurung, was one of the students who found the book's unusual format tough to follow.
Why did you make it so complicated?
Adeep, I appreciate that question. And one of my goals when I began writing The Art of Secrets was to tell a mystery that the reader had to solve by the end. All the clues are there for the reader to know who committed these crimes. And at the end of the book, Saba's own conclusions are correct, but it doesn't spell it out for you. There's no, you know, long signed confession, but the clues are there so that the reader understands what's happened and why it's happened.
Edmund's seventh grader Molly Allen wonders how much of Kleiss's own life is reflected in the story.
How is this book connected to your life?
You know, when I began The Art of Secrets, my goal was to tell a fun, sort of twisty mystery. And one of the interesting things about writing is that your intentions will change as you work on a project. And so even though when I began the story, it didn't seem to connect very much with my life, the more time I spent with those characters and explored their motives and their feelings and their experiences, the more of my own self went into the book. The times in my life when I felt like an outsider, the times in my life where I felt like a newcomer and had to make a special effort to sort of connect with my new community. I can look at each character in that book and see some aspect of myself.
The Art of Secrets is a twisty mystery that keeps the reader guessing right up to the very end, which prompted Hunt 8th grader Chloe Debadu to ask,
I would like to know what your inspiration for the twist at the end was.
Chloe, you're right. There is a twist at the end of this book, and I did know about that twist before I ever began the book. It was all part of the master plan of this crime. What was really fun to me was to see how the other characters would piece it together and how the reader could piece it together.
Chloe says she had fun figuring out how the mystery ends.
It was a surprise. I mean, I had my suspicions like everybody else, but at the end, when I finally connected the last dot, I was like, I had to take a second and be like, whoa, and think about everything that they had to piece together to pull this off. And it was really cool and inspiring.
And while figuring out the mystery was a challenge for some of these Burlington middle schoolers, they all said they had fun trying. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is The Art of Secrets by James Kleiss. Thanks to librarians Carol Rensa at Edmonds Middle School and Charles DeBritz at Hunt Middle School. Next month on Dorothy's List, The One Safe Place. It's a near-future dystopian novel by author Tanya Unsworth. When Devin's grandfather dies, leaving him alone on their farm, Devin heads for the city to find help. Once there, he finds scores of kids just like him, living alone on the streets. They tell him rumors of a place for abandoned children, with unlimited food and toys and the hope of finding a new family. But only the luckiest get there. Here's an excerpt.
Okay, listen. This is a bad idea, Kit said, talking very fast. I should just turn around and walk away from this. But here's the thing. You told that boy you wouldn't go out with me. And nobody's ever done something like that for me before. Not once. Not ever. This is a bad idea. But I can tell you you've set your mind on it, and someone's got to watch your back. You wouldn't go without me, and now I'm not going to let you go alone. Kit marched forward and got into the back seat of the waiting car.
That was Edmonds Middle School 7th grader Ruby Wool reading from The One Safe Place. It's next month's selection in our series Dorothy's List, which is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Let's go to our virtual mailbag. Producer Sam Gale Rosen joins me to help. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Jane. We're going to tackle just one subject today that got a lot of traction from listeners. On Thursday, we discussed an idea that never got off the ground, creating a national park in Vermont called the Green Mountain Parkway. It almost came to fruition in the 1930s, and it would have stretched almost the length of the state along the spine of the Green Mountains.
After the program, Haley wrote, "As a Vermonter studying the field of environmental science at UVM, I'm saddened to hear about the missed opportunity of a national park here. Perhaps the park could have been a key platform in keeping young Vermonters like me from leaving the state to find jobs elsewhere."
And Matt says, "I moved here when I was 5 years old and now run the old hotel B&B in Lincoln. Now I wonder what life would have been like had such a great project gone through. As Lincoln becomes more of a rural suburb for other places, I find myself longing for that park."
Part of the idea included building an auto road along the Green Mountains, though mostly not at the highest elevations. The plan went down in a statewide referendum in 1936. Lil in Warren says, "Horrors! I can't imagine a parkway along the spine of the Greens. Comparing the potential of such a roadway with the Blue Ridge Parkway and Skyline Drive is geographically uninformed. North Carolina and Virginia mountains in that region are nothing like what we have here. I didn't gather from the program that there's any effort to pursue that old plan, but should there be, I'd be the first to throw myself in the road in front of the construction equipment."
And HD Vote posted, "I am all in favor of protecting Vermont's natural areas, many of which are or will be under assault from development. If there had been a Green Mountain Parkway, what would have happened with the development of the interstate? Would we have ended up with an interstate highway within the park? I've hiked the Appalachian Trail and the Shenandoah and completely agree about the negative impact of Skyline Drive on the hiking experience."
And Bruce says, "My grandfather, Alfred Heininger, was the Democratic nominee for governor in 1936 and was a leading proponent of the Green Mountain Parkway. At the time, all of Vermont was economically depressed, particularly particularly northern Vermont, he saw the parkway as a way to provide jobs and promote tourism.
Bruce adds, my grandfather and grandmother, as well as my mother and her siblings, were all avid hikers and strong supporters of the Green Mountain Club. I'm told that not everyone in the family agreed that the parkway was a good idea.
Well, tell us about your good ideas for Vermont Edition. We always love to hear from you.
We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition, and you can always drop an email to vermontedition@vpr.net.
That does it for today. Tomorrow, some wells in North Bennington have tested positive for a potentially dangerous chemical. Now the state has moved on to testing over 100 private wells within a mile and a half of a former factory suspected of being the source. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the contamination, the state's response, and what happens next. You can send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. And remember, if you ever miss a program and want to catch something that you haven't heard or send it along to a friend, you can always podcast Vermont Edition, or you can find our complete archives at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Anna St. Marie assisted with research for today's show, and we had production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.